Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll talk with Marcia Jo Zarevitz, author of the book Jews of Florida, Centuries of Stories, and founding director of the Jewish Museum of Florida.
So I think we've made a major contribution to Florida history, and hopefully have inspired other ethnic groups to do the same.
We'll discuss Miami jewel thief Harry Sittamore.
The criminal career of Harry Sittamore demanded the wealth and chaos of the Florida land boom.
And we'll talk about the WPA's Florida Writers Project. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Conversos, Jews who publicly converted to Christianity under the threat of the Spanish Inquisition, probably came to Florida in the 1500s and continued practicing their religion secretly. Spanish records list people with Sephardic Jewish names among the first settlers of St. Augustine. Jewish people could not legally live in Florida until 1763, which is when Alexander Solomon, Joseph de Palacios, and Samuel Israel immigrated to Pensacola. This fascinating history and much more is preserved at the Jewish Museum of Florida in Miami Beach. Long before the museum came into existence, founding executive director Marcia Jo Zarevitz began a quest to collect and document Jewish history throughout Florida.
I moved to Florida in 1960, had always been involved in the organized Jewish community, and was rather horrified that there was no documentation of Jewish history in Florida. I couldn't understand that. I was involved nationally, and everywhere I traveled, I would meet with other women, and we talked about why we were involved, and they were involved because their mothers or their grandmothers or their aunts, somebody in the family had been involved, and I'm thinking, the Jews in Florida are really bereft of a history. There has to be something. We talk about Jewish continuity. How can you have continuity if you don't have a past? So I started asking a lot of questions because I tend to do that. And to my horror, no one had ever researched or documented it at all. The scholars up east considered Florida not important for Florida Jewish history. They assumed it began on Miami Beach after World War II, and that was the beginning and the end. So I said, no, there's got to be more to it. So I actually started a fabulous personal adventure that I think has benefited the entire state, not just the Jewish community, but the totally multi-ethnic community that we have, because the story that we are telling is of the immigrant experience. And I think some people tend to forget that all of us are of immigrant stock, of some generation. Someone came from another place to America and to Florida. So I started an 8-year adventure. I traveled around the state, starting with Pensacola to Key West, and a lot of people don't realize that's 1,000 miles. We're a very long state. And I met with people in each community, volunteers, lay people, and I said, we need to research and document the history, the Jewish history of your community. And people would constantly say, oh, there's no history here. And I said, well, whatever it is, we want to retrieve it.
Zarevitz organized teams of volunteers in 13 Jewish communities around the state, including Pensacola, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, Orlando, Tampa, Miami, and Key West. She learned how to conduct interviews from oral historian Samuel Proctor at the University of Florida. For 8 years, Zarevitz and her team of volunteers collected stories, photographs, and artifacts. Zarevitz then assembled a team of professionals to help her create a touring exhibition called Mosaic, Jewish Life in Florida. After opening at the Historical Museum of Southern Florida in Miami in October 1990, the Mosaic exhibit traveled to venues including the Flagler Museum in St. Augustine, the Museum of Florida History in Tallahassee, and the T.T. Wentworth Museum in Pensacola, introducing audiences to Florida's Jewish history.
We did not even know at the time that Jews could not live in Florida for 250 years after Florida was discovered. Only Catholics could live here from the time Ponce de Leon discovered Florida in 1513 until after the French-Indian War, when the Treaty of Paris was signed in Paris, France, in December of 1762. That was when Florida was traded from the Spanish to the British, and the British, desperate for settlement, allowed anyone to settle, including Jews. So it so happens that that same treaty gave Louisiana, took it away from the French and gave it to the Spanish. So Jews who were living in New Orleans, for example, had to leave because Jews could not live anywhere in the world under Spanish rule. And three of them went to Pensacola, Florida in 1763. So that was the beginning of documented Jewish life in Florida. We also found out that Florida was brought into statehood in 1845, the 27th state, by David Levi Yulee, a Jew. The first person of Jewish ancestry to even serve in the United States Congress, but who knew? So we have had more than 250 Jewish mayors. In other words, we have contributed, we as a Jewish community, have contributed greatly to every area of development of Florida, but nobody knew the stories. So this exhibit became very popular, and people along the way would say, you know, you've been wandering Jews long enough. People knew, even non-Jewish people know the term wandering Jews. So they said, you need to find a permanent home. Obviously, everything that you've collected, and I had collected about 6,000 photos and documents and artifacts, wasn't everything. So they said, you need a home.
In the mid-1990s, the Jewish Museum of Florida found a home in what had been Miami Beach's first synagogue in 1929 and an Orthodox synagogue next door built in 1936. Marcia Jozarevitz led the restoration of the buildings in 1993.
We're sitting now in a 1936 Art Deco design by Henry Hohauser, the most prominent of the Art Deco architects. He designed this building in 1936 as the second synagogue for the first Jewish congregation on Miami Beach that started in 1929 in the building which we now own next door. But we started in this primary building, the 80 stained glass windows, a Moorish copper dome, a sloping floor. Had a lot of challenges because how do you create a museum with a sloping floor and stained glass windows all over? But we were able to do it, and we raised the money. The building was about to be torn down, I should mention. The buildings are both on the National Register of Historic Places, but our city was letting them be torn down. So I went to the city immediately to get a moratorium against tearing them down. I said, give me 6 months to see if I can raise the money. So we did raise the money, and we restored this building. And we opened in 1995, and were extremely successful in telling the story of the immigrant experience, being focused on the Jewish story, but the acculturation process of everyone's family.
The exhibition Mosaic, Jewish Life in Florida, makes up the core of the Jewish Museum of Florida. A timeline at the front of the museum places Florida's Jewish history in a national and international context. Documents, photographs, and artifacts are displayed, including the watch belonging to George Dolinsky of Jacksonville,
who is the first known Jewish boy born in Florida in 1857. Now, there are several reasons why I like that watch. First of all, on the back, it has a relief of Moses holding the Ten Commandments. It's a beautiful artifact. And the numerals, the hours are in Hebrew Yiddish letters. But the significance of the fact that the first known Jewish boy born in Florida was so proud of his Jewish heritage that he carried this watch his whole life, and that it speaks loudly to the fact that, yes, Jews were here that early. He wasn't the first child that we know of born in Florida. There was a Jewish girl born in Pensacola. Yeah, Virginia Myers in 1822, but we don't have anything of her. We have a picture of George, and we have this artifact.
In addition to collecting Jewish history in Florida, creating the Mosaic exhibition, and establishing the Jewish Museum of Florida, Marcia Jozarevitz is author of the book Jews of Florida, Centuries of Stories, published in 2020 by the History Press. She also co-wrote The Florida Jewish Heritage Trail, published by the Florida Department of State, which identifies 250 sites of historic significance.
If I have to think of a community that is just so interesting that people don't think about it, it's Ocala. Because Ocala was, there were phosphate mines there in the early days. That's where troop trains for the Spanish-American War went through there to take troops to Tampa, to sail to Cuba. There's so much early history there. And there was a really, proportionate to the size of the population, a very large Jewish community there. That we've had mayors, we've had school superintendents, the houses of many of these people are still there. We had a state legislator, for example, Marcus Frank, who was on the city council for 40 years in Ocala, went on to become a legislator. And who would have known these stories if we hadn't done all this research with all these volunteer grassroots people all over the state? So I think we've made a major contribution to Florida history, and hopefully have inspired other ethnic groups to do the same.
With so many immigrants in our state, the Jewish Museum of Florida serves as an inspiration to everyone. The museum demonstrates the importance of documenting individual, family, and community histories.
We have children in our public schools here in Miami-Dade County from 155 different nations. In Miami Beach High School alone, we have children from 64 countries that speak 31 languages. Huge challenge for teachers. But the point here is that, again, that everyone is an immigrant and that each person needs to have the pride of knowing that they're part of America and part of Florida, not to be treated as, you know, a second-class citizen. The students that come here for field trips ranked us number one in the whole county as their favorite field trip because when they come here, they feel at home because we talk about the immigrant experience and we facilitate discussions with them about where did their families come from and why and what did they bring with them and what traditions did they bring that they had to acculturate to a new society. So, as again, it's a generic story, and that's why I think it's so important. And as you can tell, I feel very passionate about what we do.
Marcia Jo Zarevitz is founding executive director of the Jewish Museum of Florida in Miami Beach. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit our content-rich website, myfloridahistory.org, anytime to watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the story of the Miami land boom in the 1920s is one that includes a number of tales of theft and fraud, but the story of Harry Sittamore is not one that involves the sale of swampland.
The criminal career of Harry Sittamore demanded the wealth and chaos of the Florida land boom. So it seems appropriate to start with the boom itself. Although the Florida land boom of the 1920s seemed to explode onto the national scene out of nowhere, historians point to years of infrastructure construction from the railroads to the Dixie Highway, the rise of consumerism with its manifestation of what economist Thorsten Veblen called conspicuous consumption, and the positive economic position of the United States following World War I. The land boom that followed seemed convincing evidence that the American dream was in reach for everyone. And at least for a few years, it all seemed possible. We know the end of this story, but let's focus on the heyday years. Florida and Miami had attracted the wealthy for decades. And as transportation and the economy improved, middle-class Americans joined the periodic flights to the nation's own subtropical paradise, an exotic area with a reputation for the naughty that remained safely within the United States jurisdiction, as historian Julio Capo has noted. The advent of the land boom added a new layer to Miami's lure, one that encouraged the very wealthy and the adequately leveraged to construct palaces on the sand and bring with them all the evidence of their wealth, jewels, fine clothes, antique furniture, and art. Along with the ostentatious demonstrations of wealth, a criminal element appeared that included a class system of its own. Ranging from the low-level pickpockets and sneak thieves to rum runners and nationally known criminals such as Al Capone, these men and some women operated within networks that placed them in positions to perpetuate their crimes while passing as respected members of society. Indeed, a part of the adventure of spending time in South Florida included the possibility of catching sight of America's new criminal nobility.
Connie, how did Harry Sittamore fit into this criminal hierarchy?
Harry Sittamore was a jewel thief who self-identified as New York's Prince of Thieves. When he was arrested in Miami in March 1933, he had over 110 pieces of jewelry valued at between $250,000 and $500,000. Among the recovered items was a $60,000 necklace stolen from opera singer, movie star, and Tennessee Nightingale, Grace Moore. According to the Miami Herald, this was believed to be only part of his springtime haul. Indeed, Sittamore has largely been forgotten, but in the 1920s and 30s, he attained status as a self and media-style celebrity hero, as infamous as the widely written-about organized crime figures of the Prohibition-era Northeast and Midwestern bandits and bank robbers, according to historian Vivian Miller. Her article on Sittamore appeared in the winter 2009 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly and taps into a larger historiography on crime and policing in Miami. Sittamore first arrived in Miami in the early 1920s, perhaps lured by the boom chaos, as well as the vision of Carl Fisher from Miami Beach as an exclusive, upper-class, genteel, Gentile resort and residential community to rival Palm Beach. As Miller notes, Sittamore's identity as a jewel thief placed him in a small elite group of professional criminals who targeted specific privileged and high-profile individuals for their diamonds, emeralds, and other precious stones, the most ostentatious symbols of individual wealth. Professional thieves were proud of their skills and drew distinctions between themselves and common burglars who stole a range of items. Criminals like Sittamore were male and white, able to blend into elite society in order to carry out their crimes without attracting unwanted attention. Reportedly a spiffy dresser with all the appearances of a gentleman of leisure, Sittamore had more than 150 keys in his possession at the time of his arrest. He claimed to be able to open anything in Miami. After his arrest and photograph in the Miami Herald, he acquired a transnational fan club of people who compared him to the gentleman jewel thief A.J. Raffles, created by British writer E.W. Hornung. Harry considered himself to be highly intelligent and incapable of being caught by Miami's police, who he considered bumbling and inept. Perhaps all jewel thieves have this opinion of their superiority over the police, but Sittamore's view may have been bolstered by his own pre-criminal life history as an accountant and the son of a small manufacturer, social positions that suggested social mobility and some education. His view was not supported by his own rap sheet, however. Under various aliases, he had numerous arrest warrants for crimes ranging from pickpocketing to breaking and entering and jewelry store robberies. He was well known to New York and Miami police.
How did the police eventually catch Sittamore?
In the pre-dawn hours, a joint team consisting of two New York City police officers, four Miami detectives, uniformed officers, and representatives of the Knoll, Scaffa, and Pinkerton detective agencies knocked on the door of the rented Miami Beach bungalow Sittamore shared with his wife and five-year-old son. Sittamore confessed after 7 hours of interrogation. The police believed Harry had an accomplice who fed him information to facilitate the robberies, but the newspapers actually made all the information he needed readily available. According to Miller, March was party month in Miami Beach, and the daily papers reported on who was in the city, where they were staying, and occasionally provided aerial views of the homes of the rich and famous. They also printed handy lists of parties and events and who was expected to attend. Finally, they photographed these tropical visitors in all their jeweled glory. As it turned out, Sittamore did have a finger man for at least one heist. Charles Yacht, a professional golfer at a beach hotel, confessed to providing information to Sittamore about the jewelry and cash that was subsequently stolen from Mrs. Bertha Glimley on March 13th. Suspicion fell on Yacht as a known friend of Harry because he had taken Ms. Glimley's niece to the Greyhound races at a time he knew the aunt would be away. Yacht provided the police with Harry's address.
Well, Connie, how did Harry's story end?
Not well. He pleaded guilty to the theft and was sentenced to 3 consecutive terms of 20 years each, leading some to speculate that he had crossed judicial officials and was being punished for his failure to share the loot. 2 months after arriving at Rayford Prison, he escaped and fled to New Orleans. 5 months later, the dapper Harry surrendered to a Pinkerton detective and was returned to prison and placed in solitary confinement. He made 2 additional escape attempts in 1934 and 1935. According to the Florida prison superintendent, it required 5 years of punishment and discipline for Harry to become convinced that he was not bigger than the state of Florida. In 1947, he was released from prison, and in 1953, he was arrested for disorderly conduct in Miami Beach. In 1959, he was identified as the sweater man casing a jewelry store that was later robbed. As Miller concludes, it seems that only infirmity or death would halt the Prince of Thieves, as the 64-year-old Sittamore had no intention of quietly retiring to the French or any other Riviera.
A fascinating story. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker has this look at how the Works Progress Administration helped to document and preserve Florida history and culture.
The Federal Writers Project participated in several folk music collecting expeditions in Florida in the 1930s and 1940s through the Works Progress Administration, or the WPA. President Franklin D. Roosevelt created the WPA in 1935 to employ millions of Americans in a variety of public projects. The WPA not only built highways, improved infrastructure, and initiated reforestation, but also introduced important cultural programs, such as the Federal Writers Project. David A. Taylor is a filmmaker and the author of the book Soul of a People, The WPA Writers Project Uncovers Depression America.
The idea was to have writers and editors put together material for the WPA Guide to Florida. So there were the editors hired for natural history, for customs, for economy, and also for a section of the guidebook on driving routes. So they mapped out what routes they would have driving tours and described places along the way. The folk music collecting really came about later, and from the initiative of some of the writers who signed on to the project. Of course, many of them signed on because they did not have jobs. Many of them did not have writing experience, but a few did, and very few, like Zora Neale Hurston, had an idea of the cultural richness that was in Florida and that could be recorded. Hurston had worked with some folk music collecting and her own anthropological research. She was one of the first to propose music collection tours.
In 1939, author and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston wrote to Henry Alsberg and Benjamin Botkin of the Federal Writers Project to encourage them to record folk songs in Florida. Shortly after her proposal, Hurston headed to Florida to collect songs in Jacksonville and in a turpentine camp in Cross City. Jacksonville native Stetson Kennedy dropped out of the University of Florida to become the state director of the Federal Writers Project Unit on Folklore, Life History, and Social Ethnic Studies for the WPA. Accompanied by Zora Neale Hurston, he embarked on a folk song collecting journey through his home state for the Federal Writers Project. Hurston, an African-American woman from Eatonville, was instrumental during the folk song collecting expeditions in Florida. She acted as a valuable liaison between the mostly white Federal Writers Project folklorists and the black communities they visited in Florida, such as Belleglade, Chosin, Cross City, Eatonville, and Jacksonville.
Basically, the roots that people like Zora Neale Hurston and Stetson Kennedy mapped out for recording songs looked at places like soup kitchens, turpentine camps in the woods, cigar factories, in Ybor City and Tampa, people's homes in some cases. They were trying to capture the folk culture, the people's culture from north to south through the state. The WPA writers, they were looking for the range of cultures across Florida as Hurston had mapped out in her memo plan for the recording tour. They wanted to capture everything from traditional songs sung by turpentine workers in the camps far from towns to urban centers to Stetson Kennedy recorded his young Cuban wife singing songs that she remembered from her childhood. So recorded other family members that she knew in the Ybor City part of Tampa. They recorded Bahamian songs, and so they gathered a wide range of people. Some really wonderful singers, some complete amateurs. One of the poignant ones I thought for myself was a young man, James Griffin, in the Turpentine camp at Cross City, who sang about being detained just for not paying the company for the debts that he accrued while working for them. So I think some of the stories behind the songs of the people that they came across are really powerful.
Ray calls come alone. I didn't see Marie Ruth there. Ray calls come alone. I didn't see Marie Ruth there. I ain't got no money, and my friends, they don't even care.
Between 1935 and 1942, writers, historians, researchers, and artists working on behalf of the federal government set out to find America's folk culture, one state at a time. The Federal Writers Project carried out some of the most impressive undertakings in the history of folklife studies when they traveled across the country to record various facets of American history and life. As they explored every corner of the United States, they invited ordinary Americans to share their own stories. David A. Taylor.
The songs that they collected were sometimes the first time these people got a public voice. And so they may have been singing songs that they were confident of because they had grown up with them, or they had maybe even made them up themselves. But nobody had asked them before for these. And so I think the significance is both what they give us as the public for songs and part of life that would have otherwise disappeared, but also for the people who sang them, they gave a recognition that their lives mattered.
Because of the music preservation efforts of the Library of Congress and the federal government, we can still hear these songs today. They offer a glimpse into life in Florida during the Great Depression. Visit the Florida Folklife from the WPA Collection, 1937 to 1942, at loc.gov to listen to hundreds of songs recorded by the Federal Writers Project in Florida. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. You can always find us online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.